and the canonical theory, you see it because the constraints define your dynamics, but these constraints come from the Feldman symmetry in the continuum. On the other hand, you know, you can just see the evolution as a time reformatization, so it's a coordinate transformation. So evolution is kind of a diffeomorphism transformation. And if you think about effective field theory, where you start to write like the most general diffeomorphism invariant action, or all the terms which are diffeomorphism invariant, that would be very hard to do on a lattice, for instance. And then there are uniqueness theorems by Teitelbaum and Kukash and Heumann, which basically tell you if you prescribe the type of variables you use, and especially the number, then requiring diffeomorphic symmetry gives you uniquely general relativity. So if you have diffeomorphic symmetry, you can be at least sure that there is general relativity, also probably the simplest term, but you can, of course, get more. In the quantum gravity, it would mean that it would emerge in the semi-classical limit. So this brings us, if we do a discretization, to the questions, is there a notion of diffeomorphic symmetry in discrete models? And implementing it, or requiring diffeomorphic symmetry to emerge at some point, can it help us to address ambiguities and anomalies and lattice effects? Can it help us to restrain the path integral measure? Because usually that's where your anomaly sits for gauge symmetries. And to understand the sum over triangulations. Okay. So I will rush through the first slide because you will probably have all been to the talk yesterday. So this will give you concretely a few graphs to show whether we don't have diffeomorphic symmetry in discrete gravity. I will give a few more detail on this thing of improving the dynamics with renormalization, and especially focus on a perturbative expansion. And here the problem will be that if you do a perturbative expansion around a solution which has more symmetries than the perturbations, you might get some problems. And we will encounter these problems. And finally, I will discuss the repercussions for the canonical formalism, and if there's time, basically tell you what the constraints are on the triangulation for linearized stretchy calculus. Okay. So you all probably know stretchy calculus. It takes a Einstein-Hilbert action and discretize it in this nice form. It looks quite simple. So we have the deficit angles, which give us a curvature. Here it's more or less a square root of G term. So in four dimensions, these are the areas, minus the cosmological constant term. And I come to the first two points, namely, is there a notion of diffeomorphic symmetry in discretized actions? And does the Ricci action satisfy this notion? And what I'm going to do is to apply really this dynamical definition. If you have non-uniqueness of solutions for fixed boundary conditions, then you usually speak of gauge symmetries. And if you have non-uniqueness, what happens is that the Hessian evaluated on the solution has null eigenvectors. So we basically test this condition that the determinant of the Hessian evaluated on the solution vanishes. Of course, here you have the action and you have to calculate the solution. So the existence of symmetries really depends on the dynamics of your system. Also, you see that different solutions might have gauge orbits of different sites. General comment is that invariance of the action alone under some symmetries is not sufficient for having gauge symmetry, because you can have a rotational invariant action and only have a solution on the basic maximum of your rotational invariant thing. Okay. As we will see, this criterion is relevant for the canonical analysis to find whether you have constraints or exact constraints or not. For perturbative expansion, And of course, for the counting of physical degrees of freedom. And it was, yes?
Is it equivalent in the canonical analysis to there being first class constraints?
To have constraints.
First class constraints.
To have constraints at all. First class constraints, yeah. But if you don't have symmetries, you have pseudo constraints. You don't have.
No, right. So I'm looking for what's the Sharp statement? So you're given a criteria in the Lagrangian.
Yeah. So if you have symmetries, then you will find first class constraints.
Is a symmetry the same thing as a gauge symmetry?
Yes. If you find a gauge symmetry, yeah.
Okay. By your criteria, then there will be first class constraints.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
This is in the continuum, which is well known. we have shown it for discrete dynamics.
Right, that's my question.
Okay. Yeah. And this system allows you for continuum dynamics. Okay, two constraints you only have the discrete dynamics. Okay.
The criterion is satisfied for pseudo constraints.
Pseudo constraints, yeah.
Your criterion is still satisfied.
No, if you have broken symmetries, you don't get constraints. I mean, you don't get constraints from these symmetries. You might have other constraints hanging around, but you get these things which are called pseudo constraints, which are just equations of motion which have a weak decoupling between the variables on two different time steps. So if you solve your evolution equation, you just have the problem that you have to invert very small numbers. That's why you can still call them something like pseudo-constraint.
But what is that your criterion is satisfied?
No, the criterion is not satisfied. If you don't, if you have broken symmetries, then the determinant is not zero. So that's.
Okay, then it's not necessary to add. If there are symmetries, then the criterion gives rise to constraints. It told this.
The criterion is to define what are symmetries. Sorry. So that's, the criterion is saying, we define to have a gauge symmetry if this criterion is satisfied. Okay.
And then that's about this pseudo constraints.
I come to the. Okay, we can ask that, but I have a part at the end. Okay, but.
No, just saying that means more. You're assuming that the symmetry is broken by some small parameter, and that's why the pseudo is non zero, but it's small.
Yeah, I will. The next slide. I will tell you what the small parameter is. Okay, so basically it was known for quite some time that if you have a flat solution, then you have these gauge symmetries, you evaluate the hashing, you can evaluate the hashing on the flat solution, and you find that you have these gauge symmetries. And indeed, these correspond to moving this vertex. If you have here a tetrahedron, you want to solve for the four edge lengths. You find the solution by just putting the vertex inside this flat tetrahedron, but you find many more solutions by moving this vertex around and calculating the induced edge lengths. And this is also the case for 4D and survives in the linearization. And in this linearization, you can show that these gauge modes which you get are matched to the continuum diffeomorphic symmetry gauge modes. Okay, so we took a specific example of a triangulation and calculated the solution numerically and evaluated the hatching on this solution. And what we see here is a plot of the smallest eigenvalue, I mean, with the smallest modulus. And the x-axis is a parameter which goes linearly in the deficit angle of the solution, so it gives you the curvature. And you see, so here you are on a flat solution, you have a zero eigenvalue, and you go away, so you turn in your boundary condition, you turn the curvature on, and you find that it changes quadratically. Now I say small, I, I, I here I omitted the numbers, but there's a difference between the smallest eigenvalue, say at this order, and the next one, I think of 7 orders. So that's why I say small. And indeed, for numerical ratchet calculus, this is the main difficulty of these two different, very different scales. So what you actually do?
This is not gate symmetric.
No, it is. Yes. Yeah.
It is.
It is not.
It is not, right?
It is not for if you have a curvature, if you have basically a curved solution. A solution is curvature. If you have a vertex which sits in a region with curvature, it does not allow for this notion. I mean, you see, it does not allow, it has a unique solution.
So what happens to equivalence principle?
There's a huge discussion about metacoupling in ratchet calculus, because what happens there is that they tell you that there are difficulties in preserving the energy momentum tensor for matter. But so you make, what happens is that you make small mistakes with continuum dynamics, of course.
Yeah, well, the thing I'm worried about is that you gravity was a Gauss theory, and you're saying this discretized version is not a Gauss theory. So then I don't really have a criterion for writing the operators, because I don't have.
Then that's my problem. So.
Well, why is there only one small eigenvalue?
Oh, because we symmetry reduce the calculation to not be. I mean, it's like a calculation with it's an example with. I forgot 19 edges or something, and you put certain edge lengths equal to each other, so there's only one potential gauge symmetry left. Okay.
So the magnitude to the next, the change to the next eigenvalue is 7 orders, and that is this is the main difficulty in numerical ratchet calculus, and I think that is why was not really very adopted in numerical relativity. Yes?
Is that would affect how big the problem was?
Yeah. I mean, this is linear in curvature. It goes quadratic in this thing. Cannot. I have to check what angle it wants.
What sets this scale 10 plus 7?
The boundary, the size, or not even the size of the boundary, because the scale anyway. It's just the curvature angle. Ratchet calculus is scale anyway.
Yes.
If I multiply the full thing.
There should be some dimensionless number which.
This is a deficit angle. Yeah, it's a deficit angle.
I think I
can check. What really the deficit angle is in this case, but I just don't know. I have to check it in the paper.
Yeah. But just because you made that comment, I think this problem could probably be handled because of you introduce some version of lapse and shift, which is free. So Mark Miller worked at this problem. You said that this was the main reason that rigid calculus was not developed for numerical relativity. I think the real reason, I don't think that was the stumbling block so much. I think that probably it was more than anything just lack of interest on part of most people. But if there was going to be a really serious problem, it would have been with stability of the whole scheme, like in the other approaches.
Okay, we found this deviation too, which goes up with epsilon squared. If you take your triangulation, then you will find that the 4D ratchet action, I don't mean actually the action, I mean the Hamilton Jacobi functional, is invariant under certain changes of triangulation. And these changes are 1,5, 5,1, 2,4, and 4,2 Pachner moves. And for instance, the 1,5 is you take one simplex in your triangulation, you subdivide it with putting a vertex in the somewhere in the simplex, and you obtain 5 new simplices. But what happens is that this is a trivial subdivision in the sense that the new solution will be a flat, will be the same flat simplex, so you don't do anything to your Hamilton-Jacobi functional. The same holds for the 2,4.
And for the others, you can easily check that the equation of motion is decoupled. So if you have such a configuration, it has to be flat. Okay, so we are left with the 3-3. And for the simplest case one can consider, namely that you have really the 3-3 involves three simplices, you switch to another configuration which has the same boundary as these three simplices, but where the bulk triangulation changes, namely the inner triangle switches, and what we can just do is to evaluate the retroaction. So here you don't really have to calculate the Hamilton-Jacobi because there's no equation of motion, there's no inner edges. You can evaluate the actions of these two configurations and take the difference, and you find that also here, with the curvature of this is the deficit angle of this inner triangle, there's a certain possibility that this is really the deficit angle. You find a quadratic effect. So it's really happening with the same scale in the curvature. Okay. So why do we care about whether these symmetries are there or not? As if I manage, I might try to explain that exactly. Yeah?
Physics is that two histories described by regular triangulations which differ by a 3-3 move correspond, we have to say, to gauge in equivalent histories.
Yes, if you this is notation of
is that as long as there is curvature, which is the generic case, there is no continuous symmetry, so two different choices of edge lengths correspond to physically distinct configurations.
Two solutions with different edge lengths.
Two histories with different edge lengths and the same triangulations, when there's curvature,
yes,
correspond to physically distinct histories.
Yes.
Yeah. So now what? Isn't that good? Why do we care? But isn't that a good thing? Doesn't that mean that you have the gauge and variant description of the histories generically?
No, because in the continuum's limit, I mean, you would like and you would expect, and you have to ensure actually that that these, I mean, you have these finite eigenvalues, that these eigenvalues go to zero. Because if you want to get the continuum limit, I mean, if you want to get the continuum limit correct, you, for instance, want to get the correct number of physical degrees of freedom.
If the symmetries get much smaller than the curvature or something.
Yeah, if you go to the continuum limit, if you do it with fat symmetries, then they do. Indeed. Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, if you would have exact symmetries, you would find exact first class constraints. I care because I mean that is if you regularize by discretization anomalies in your constraint algebra, if you do it really canonically, whereas if you try to represent your symmetry algebra, you typically can fix your ambiguities in your quantization. Then, as I will show you, that might be another reason. If you do a perturbative expansion and try to calculate graviton scattering on a fixed triangulation, it is very subtle if the symmetries are broken. In the path integral computation, if you do it perturbatively, again, you will find that there is no propagator for the gauge modes, or for the pseudo-gauge modes in this case, but they appear in the higher order terms. So, I mean, you wouldn't know how to solve that. We can solve it non-perturbatively, but okay. And you might want to have a condition on the measure in the path integral such that it ensures that you get something diffeomorphous and invariant in the continuum.
What is pseudo-gauge bound?
the pseudo gauge mode, this definition would be the eigenmode. It's a very small eigenvalue. This is very small eigenvalues. But I will explain later in the 1D examples.
So is that just to say that what used to be a gauge, just a gauge degree of freedom, is now real?
It's now a physical.
It's not physical, okay.
It appears in the action explicitly, but only in the higher order terms.
Yeah.
If you expand around something which has symmetry. Okay, so the question is, can we construct better actions? The answer, yeah, you can try by randomization group transformation, as I was explaining yesterday. So you fine grain and integrate out the fine grained degrees of freedom. And we are trying it classically first to see what happens. So it's solving the equation of motion for these fine grained degrees of freedom. You obtain an effective action on the coarse grained lattice, capturing the dynamics of the fine grained lattice. And the question is, does it work for local gauge symmetries from the continuum? Because this is an idea taken from quantum homodynamics, where it works for Lorentz symmetry, which is a global symmetry. So again, this basically, the idea is quite simple. Say you want to compute some kind of partition function for this boundary, then you want basically do the summation in two steps. So first you have this very fine lattice. So you can try to find first the partition function by renormalization defined on this intermediate lattice, and then do the second summation step in a separate step. But the first thing will give you an effective action defined on this coarse-grained lattice. Here you get another effective action, and here you get another effective action. Of course, you would expect that the final summation will give you the same partition function in all three cases. So what we are interested in is basically this expression on the intermediate lattices. And you could see this also. In this, we have to see analogous to different triangulation, and this represent the vertex translation. So very roughly, I see that equivalent to the Dirac hypersurface deformation algebra, which basically gives you the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints. And they can be actually derived as a condition that the final evolved state does not depend on the intermediate hypersurface. And here we have basically the same. We want that the lattice that the final partition function does not depend on the intermediate lattice. And it would be interesting to derive a notion of a lattice deformation algebra, and at least for these vertex translations, which so far also appear as a notion for what the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints do for discretized surfaces. So in some sense, there should be a subgroup, the vertex translation algebra, which should be similar to the hypersurface deformation algebra. Okay, so maybe it will be a bit clearer if I can discuss the examples. I showed this example yesterday, the 3D redshift is a cosmological constant. So the standard discretization is this flat, piecewise flat tetrahedra, and you basically have this cosmological constant term there. This has unique solutions. They have approximate symmetries, and you find that basically your Hamilton-Jacobi functional is triangulation dependent. And maybe I will comment too why we should care. Because there was also a paper by Gambini and Pullin which basically gave the same argument as you, that we should be happy that we. Okay. So here is if you actually, what I will explain in a minute, if you solve for these dashed, and actually here also part of these edges, edges, and do this refinement and the sense this refinement to the continuum, you will find this action, which actually is the action for homogeneously curved tetrahedra. So here's really the deficit angle which you compute in a homogeneously curved tetrahedron, and here's the volume which you compute in the homogeneously curved tetrahedron. The interesting thing is that you cannot really write this volume explicitly as a function of the length variable. I found many PhD theses which are trying to clarify this question, but Laurent has an expression. Okay. So how is this calculation?
So you're saying you have a tetrahedron that's curved. It's not in flat space, is that?
If you take a sphere and draw a geodesic triangle, this defines you a triangle in a homogeneously curved space.
So you want like a four sphere.
If you have
a three sphere
and draw a geodesic tetrahedron, you define the volume of that and define the deficit angle, which is the angle between the faces. You find all these things. Yes.
Okay. So you did, just if you go back to the previous slide. So you did a renormalization group transformation by integrating out the edge lengths, which are diagonal. And the renormalized action is there. Are there additional higher order terms, or is that the entire renormalized result of the?
This is a fixed point.
But when you, that's the next claim, but when you do the renormalization group transformation, as you indicated, are these the leading terms in the effective action, or are these?
For intermediate lattices?
Yes.
Yeah, the additional terms, because you find this in the continuum limit.
So there are additional terms?
Because he's asking whether this is the full action. This is the full action you get on the right hand side.
This is the fixed point action, and I'm going to explain on the next slide.
The question is whether this is the full answer, and yes, this is the full answer.
Yes, if you do the refinement, if you send the refinement to the continuum, only then, in between you have some complicated mess, which I can't even compute, you see that in this calculation.
Okay, good, go ahead.
It's just the, so you start with the stretch action,
and you put Lagrange multipliers requiring that the sum of, and in this case, consider this coarse-grained edge. So we have small edge lengths here. So for each of these big edges, you require that the sum of these edges should be equal to this big LE. And these big LE are just parameters, non-dynamical variables and for this action. So you write the equation of motions. So you take this equation of motion, you resum, you find this expression. So here, you use Euler identity, just says that L dv dl is equal to 3v. And here, this looks a bit confusing, but this is really just given by the capital LEs, so you use this equation times the alpha E's. So this is 0, it comes from the equation of motion, and we have this term here, and we have this term here. So we take this term and replace it by everything which is on the right-hand side. So we find the following. We find this result. So instead of minus the volume, we get two times the volume, because we have a minus 3 here. And what happens is basically that here, this homogeneous curvature gets shifted into the volume term, and we have this LE and this alpha E. And this alpha E now, which has been a Lagrange multiplier, of course looks like an angle again, but in principle you would have to solve this equation of motion to find, this is the equation of motion to fix alpha E. So in general, for general triangulation, I cannot really calculate that for you, because it's actually a transcendental equation. But one can argue that in the continuum limit, this is actually the first Taylor expansion of a deficit angle for a curved tetrahedron. So in the continuum limit, you will find that this is really the deficit angle of a curved tetrahedron. And similarly, that should have been a big sigma. This volume, if you refine enough, is the volume of a curved tetrahedron.
The equations of motion rather than doing a path integral over the edge lengths that you're testing.
I would like to do a path integral. I just don't know this one. So the next question is, okay, is there a quantization of this wrong action?
So I have a question.
So let me just answer. Is there a quantization of this action? I don't know of any. I know a quantization of this action. It's a 2-Hall-Friedel model.
An interesting project would be to repeat this in the quantum case. So if you give me the quantization of this thing, we can discuss again.
Field theory, and we know a great deal about.
No, this is the two of the field should appear as a fixed point. But the question is, can you give me a quantization of this thing? I don't have one. I mean, I can try to fix Cosano redshale, it's actually.
Right, because you don't know what the measure is.
No, it's not trivial to put the cosmological constant in, so I don't know of any quantization of that. And then it would be, even if you start with Cosano redshale,
it would be very interesting to see whether this happens or not. Because there's a quantum group structure in the 2-Hall-Friedel, so I have no idea. But this is the assumption Gambini and Pullin are basically hoping on, that this same will happen in the quantization. So this would be really the test, because we hope that it happens in quantum. Mm-hmm. And here, I just say, in this case, we have the quantization for the exact action, also it looks much more complicated. But we don't have this thing, because we know that this is asymmetry, so this is just to support the argument it might be easier to quantize something with symmetry. So. Also concerning the degrees of freedom. So here we really have many, many degrees of freedom. But what happens is somehow statistically they should all have very short correlation lengths, and then the continuum limits somehow disappear. But this has to be made sure in the quantization. And if you speak to guys which have experience in these things, they always doubt that. But we hope that this will happen in the quantization.
Talk about this finite refinement. Do you mean that you take infinitely many little simplices inside the big simple?
Yeah.
Because normally you would think that you have to do it with just a rough subdivision and then iterate the procedure instead.
No, here it's easier, even the perfect action guys. I mean, here it's, in this case it's easier to immediately go to the continuum. Because I have this expression.
I mean, in this case, there was a three summing.
If you do it one step, or if you do it step by step, you end up in the same place. So it's not at all clear that if you just integrate it step by step, you'll get the same effective action as if you integrate every single one step.
I think we have some. I mean,
in the quantum case, it's not clear, I agree. In the classical case, we have some arguments that this should happen.
In this 3D case, is the solution you're talking about just a sphere, or just a decision or something?
Yeah.
So then everything's motionless anyway, right? So
yeah.
You might expect it to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a special thing in 3D.
Yeah, it's
topological.
I mean, that's the reason why they put it down explicitly.
Yeah, do you think it might rely on that? Do you think it might be a lie on that thing? Because it seems like if you just get out from watching this.
That's why we have to test the 4D case, to see what happens in the 4D case. So,
So the same can be discussed in 1D reparametrization environment systems. So you can just take your preferred classical system and the first deparameterize it so that you have time reparameterization invariance. You can discretize this Lagrangian. You find this discrete Lagrangian. And you will also find that you have vertex translation symmetries if you have vanishing potential, and you have broken symmetries if you have a non-vanishing potential. So if a vanishing potential, we know the solution is a straight line, and it's well approximated by straight lines. So that's the reason why you can actually shift these vertices around. If you have, for instance, a harmonic oscillator, you will basically find different solutions depending on your discretization scale. So the position of these vertices are really fixed by your equation of motion, but you find this, what I call the one pseudo-gauge mode, and this you can really identify because if you linearize around the solution, around the solution, you find that the kinetic term of this pseudo-gauge mode vanishes, so there's no propagator in it, but you have gauge breaking in the potential. Okay, and here I put this piecewise linear pieces by hand. So actually, I use a discretization which somehow used the most simplest case of approximating the derivative, but it's not necessarily piecewise linear, as we will see, because if you take another discretization based on the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, we will find our symmetries again, and we will basically find it doesn't depend in which discretization we calculate. We basically find always vertices on this trajectory, which is a continuum trajectory. And as a remark, I would make a mistake in approximating this trajectory. For instance, with this square, if I would put something piecewise linear in here, I would of course make a certain mistake in representing my solution. So these two examples just show that the existence of symmetries depend on the dynamics and on your choice of action. And you can try to improve your dynamics by constructing action that approximates the continuum dynamics better or perfectly. And also the interpretation of discrete building blocks depends on your dynamics. So whether they are flat or curved or homogeneity curved or with knots in it depends basically on what the dynamics prescribes for them. So of course we come to the central question of 4D, where I cannot really tell you much, but
Elise comment early on. And suppose we did this one dimensional thing and didn't try to be clever at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just use the piecewise linear. Would you get spurious gauge modes? If so, would they be very massive so that they didn't really matter? Or, you know, would you...
So they don't propagate.
What's the harmonic oscillator?
This harmonic oscillator you find if you linearize around the solution, and they don't appear in the quadratic term, but they appear to higher order.
So what does that mean if you try
to you could say you have infinite mass, but if you try to do explicit calculations and because there's basically no propagator term for them.
I mean, suppose you just tried to do a path integral using that.
Yeah.
Would you get good answers or not? That's really what. Can you say whether or not?
I don't. In the perturbative expansion, I don't know how to compute the path integral because the first term where they appear is in the third or fourth order thing. So the Hessian, I mean, first the Hessian has a zero eigenmode, but the potential is violating. I will explain it in the perturbative expansion.
Okay, so you're saying you don't know the answer, but because in the perturbative expansion, it's too difficult to analyze.
I know how to do a perturbative expansion by actually doing this improvement step by step to get rid of.
Yeah.
to shift this gauge breaking term to higher potential terms. But I will try to explain on the next slides why it might be difficult.
Wouldn't this be a good test case? I mean, I tend to feel the way Lee also does, or seem to, which is that this might not really be a problem. It might even be a good thing. So it amounts to a choice of measure, perhaps, particular choice of measure.
Yeah, we test them so, when we do this. I mean, a student does it.
And do you get a...
He does it, and I mean, he's in the process of...
Oh, he is doing it. He is doing it.
He is doing it. But so far, I mean, we looked at this thing, and perturbatively, we would have not really an idea how to evaluate the passing the
So we should know soon.
I mean, if you can tell me, then how you integrate something which is not minus the square, but even...
But the effect is small, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the discretization effect, so it's small if you discretize fine enough.
Yeah, so...
So, but I will tell you, I will come to that the next two slides, what the problem is in a perturbative approach. Okay. So 4D is, of course, much more difficult as 3D. It's impossible to solve the equation of motion non-perturbatively. So what one could try is an expansion around flat space. And you can ask, what are the properties of this expansion? And it's important expansion because that is what I understand is currently what one currently tries to have a graviton propagator and scattering amplitudes. So we just take our reaction and expand our variables, in this case edge lengths, in powers of a small parameter epsilon, which has nothing to do with the depth of the angle. And there's one puzzle, namely, we know that linear stretching on a flat space-time, the solutions are not unique, but also, if you go to the full theory, the solutions are unique. So what happens? And we will really see that typically a consistent expansion is only possible for specific choices of the background gauge. For other choices, your first order solution goes with epsilon to the minus 1. Basically, this epsilon to the minus 1 forces you to the preferred unique solution. And there's a precise relation with the invariance properties of the truncated Hamilton-Jacobi functional. The consistent expansion, meaning that in this expansion, you always assume that the solutions don't go with 1 over epsilon. I mean, you always assume that the first order is smaller than the zeroth order, and the second order is smaller than the first order, and so on. But here, if it goes with epsilon to the power of minus 1 and assume epsilon to be small, you get a huge thing.
What is the
right gauge? I will tell you.
You will tell
me. I mean, this is basically, it depends on the action. It's a
thing that comes out of the regi. Isn't it?
I have to compute it numerically. So, for the harmonic oscillator, it's a regular subdivision. But for general triangulation, I couldn't find any symmetry or something. So I look only at one example, but I will characterize it with the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, but it won't help you much.
It works for all different curvatures. I would have thought it would depend on the curvature that you introduced.
Which curvature? Sorry.
Well, let's see. When you
here, this epsilon has no curvature in it.
Okay, but I mean, this is in a curved back. You're introducing a small curvature, if I understand. Is that right?
Yeah. But the curvature is something dynamic.
Yes.
Okay,
go on then.
Yeah. I will explain what happens. So, we take our expanded action, we look at linear order, we find that since this was the definition of having a gate symmetry on flats, which we have on flat space, we find null modes in our Hessian. So for later reference, I make this coordinate transformation. So O stands just for the order. So I do that for all orders into gauge modes and physical modes. So what I find to linear order is that my background gauge, so the zeroth order here, my background gauge and the first order gauge variables remain free, but my physical linear mode is of course determined. What I will find to first nonlinear order is that still my linear gauge mode and my second gauge mode, the gauge mode of second order, remains free, but the second order of my physical mode is determined. So XP1 is determined, XP2 is determined, XG1 and XG2 remain free, but here we still have an equation of motion for the gauge modes. And what happens with this equation of motion, so if you take this equation of motion, which is actually exactly the just the equation of motion contracted with the gauge and contracted into gauge direction, at second order, so we already put here in the physical the solution for the physical modes, we will find that this is equal to the Hamilton-Jacobi functional of the linear theory, so this defined to something which is of second order. But you take the derivative of this Hamilton-Jacobi functional in direction of the gauge mode. So this is the derivative of the Hamilton-Jacobi functional with respect to the background gauge parameter. And there's this background gauge parameter because that is where you put your vertex in and define your expansion around. So this thing which surprised us that this can be computed in the linearized theory, and this is an equation of motion in the nonlinear theory, but what does it imply? It implies that the first order and second order gauge variables do not appear in the equation of motion, because they don't appear here. So if the equation of motion is not automatically zero, you have to use it as a consistency condition for the background gauge parameters. But for the background gauge parameters, it's a nonlinear equation. And it is automatically zero if actually the Hamilton-Jacobi functional of the linearized theory does not depend on the background gauge parameters. So the interpretation, how do these background gauge parameters get fixed? They get fixed such that the dependence of the Hamilton-Jacobi functional on these parameters is minimal. Does not help you practically, but basically gives you a characterization of this fixing. So the question is, does the Hamilton-Jacobi functional for linear spatial calculus depend on a background gauge? And it does. So we were actually a bit surprised. Because I expected that in this, to the first nonlinear order, the first gauge mode gets fixed, but it does. And it also does for the 1D examples. So if you want to avoid to have to solve here an equation of motion nonlinearly, because what basically this perturbation theory allows you is to boil everything down to linear equations, you have to start with a background gauge, which automatically gives you this nice property of satisfying basically this equation. But then it goes on to higher order. So basically, you get somehow nonlinear equations in your perturbative expansion. So there was
what is the physical meaning of the Hamilton-Jacobi function now?
It defines all the solutions of the theory.
Okay, that's a circular argument.
It's a classical equivalent to the partition function.
Yeah, but what is it? If it's minimum, it means that. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means that you have a classical solution, or
no? I mean, this is everything is classical, but it means that you go to the point where, if you change the background, this vertex, your Hamilton-Jacobi changes minimally.
to understand that what means, I mean, in some other simpler language.
It means that you put the vertex such that your end design does minimally depend on the position of the vertex. Mm-hmm. So your physics should minimally depend on the position of the vertex.
Okay. So it's just saying that you have to minimize respect to gauge, pseudo gauge modes as
yeah.
well. Okay, so that's sure.
Can you go back? I got a little lost on these XJs, XI, they're leg lengths? What are they? Edge lengths?
Square? Yeah, edge lengths. It just said this is a completely arbitrary general argument.
And have you put boundary conditions?
I put boundary conditions. So this is for the variables. Put boundary conditions, forget about the boundary conditions. So this is for the variables, for your real dynamical variables you want to solve for.
And could the choice of the gauge depend on the boundary conditions? I think that's effectively what I was asking.
We found in this example that they do not depend on the first order boundary conditions.
I see, they're independent to first order, but to higher order.
We found it in this example, there might be a general argument for this, but I don't know. But to higher order, we didn't try to higher order.
I see.
So I found it quite surprising that it does not, but.
Yeah, it is a bit surprising. So what triangulation was it? I mean, do you know roughly?
You take a five-dimensional vertex, which you get by doing two simplices. You do a tent move. You do another tent move. This is a triangulation we consider. You get one inner vertex in the middle. And you put boundary conditions outside. And to simplify the problem, we put some requirements on the lengths that some lengths are equal to each other.
So in the end, there's one free vertex in the interior?
There's one free vertex.
I see.
So, but this applies also to arbitrary systems. This applies to an arbitrary number of variables. It's a general.
That's saying about the first order, independence of the first order?
This.
Of the boundary conditions to first order is true for arbitrary?
No, this turned out to be the case for the harmonic oscillator. And this example.
This special example was the one
that's in general. This calculation is general. Okay.
And when you say Hamilton-Jacobi function, you mean the square of the gradient? What exactly is the definition of
Hamilton? Oh, it's just the action evaluated on the solution. So the actually Hamilton's principal function.
I see.
Some call it. Okay. So the surprising thing was that actually linearized gravity has constraints for the linearized constraints, but the Hamilton-Jacobi function is not triangulation independent in the sense because it depends where I put my vertices. Again, in these examples with a harmonic oscillator or unharmonic oscillator, I have this difficulty that basically these gauge modes appear to higher order and not in the quadratic order. So what it told us is if we want to improve the ratchet action perturbatively, we have to start with the quadratic part. So the idea would be to improve this quadratic part. We take this. So now the background gauge should be arbitrary to nonlinear order, but then we have to improve the next order to ensure that the first order gauge is arbitrary to arbitrary high order. And this scheme, okay, it works for the harmonic oscillator, where you even don't need to go to higher order because you find the exact perfect action already in this order, but it also works for the unharmonic oscillator.
What means a cubic?
It doesn't matter because okay. Yeah, so for the quadratic action, for the quadratic order, what one can try, or what we try, is take some regular triangulation to do this refining process. And in principle, one can basically solve that because it's a linear problem. And so this is the general solution for a linear theory. If you have gauge modes, you need to do a bit more because you cannot invert this first thing, and then you cannot invert the second thing. So you have to put projections onto the physical modes in between. And what we are currently doing is to evaluate that for the Ratcher action and try to find a geometric interpretation for the result. But it's a bit difficult because the Ratcher, in this case, we have to deal with basically 15-dimensional matrices and to play around with them and do lots of diagonalizations. And so far, we don't see that this diagonalization we have to do does nicely interact with this coarse-graining operator. So we will try further or give up at some point, but this is where we stand at the moment. okay, so how long can I go on?
It's 5 minutes. Move towards the end. We were a little bit late.
Yeah, so let me maybe clarify all these different things about constraints. So what we do is, what usually happens in deriving constraints is that you take your continuous action, you do a Legendre transformation, and then you discretize, you get a discrete canonical formalism. But if you do this form, you somehow assume a continuous time, but then typically you find anomalous constraints. So the constraints don't close anymore. And I think what was, what people did actually more in numerics, of course, and then it was advertised by Gambini and Pauline, was to take the continuous action, to discretize, to do a Legendre transformation. You find a discrete canonical formalism, which has a discrete time, discrete space, but typically you don't find constraints if you don't have the symmetry, but you find these pseudo-constraints. And again, these pseudo-constraints are basically these equations which weakly couple between different time steps. And I think if you ask me, the difficulty in quantum theory is that you want to impose some kind of condition on fluctuations representing these pseudo-gauge modes. But it's hard to say it concretely. I mean, you want to basically, instead of a delta function on your constrained hypersurface, you have something like a Gaussian. And you don't have an algebra. So you lose basically this principle of trying to not find, to fix ambiguities. Okay, I told you several times that if you have exact symmetries, you find actually first class constraints. And just for Raphael, how do we define the canonical formalism for Ratchet Kaipelos? We use the 10 moves, and then we imply so what are 10 moves? Take a vertex in your triangulation. In this case, it's a 2 plus 1 dimensional triangulation, so this is a 2 dimensional surface. Put a tent on it, and you connect the vertices to obtain a tent. And the nice thing about these tent moves is that it's a local action, so in principle you can parallelize it. For the Hamiltonian viewpoint, it means that you can evolve different vertices independently, or basically have at least a discretized notion of a hypersurface algebra. And they don't change the spatial triangulation, the number of variables, so it's easier to do a phase-based description of these things. And basically, we use the framework of this consistent discretization to define a canonical transformation. So this defines you momenta conjugated to the length variables and canonical transformations defining your evolution, time evolution. And you can do that for four-valent vertex. Four-valent vertex, it turns out, will allow only for flat dynamics. So it will put itself into a region where all the deficit angles are zero. And in this case, you have symmetries, and you find these constraints. So the dynamics of a four-simplex is that you have these constraints. They fix you all the degrees of freedom, so you have 0 degrees of freedom. And the meaning of these constraints is the following. If you do a Cauchy transformation, you can transform to momenta conjugated to the areas. And then it says that the momenta conjugated to the areas is completely fixed as a function of the time, of the length. And this function of the lengths are actually given by the dihedral angles of the simplex. So it gives you the extrinsic curvature of the surface as a function of the length, which the intrinsic curvature, intrinsic geometry, which the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints usually do. Okay. Well, it was here. It was here. Yeah. So we have 0 physical degrees of freedom, which nicely corresponds to the fact that you don't have any curvature on the four simplex. The bit surprising fact is that gives you very complicated functions, but these constraints are abelian. So they are really first class. Okay, so you can do the same for the linearized constraints, and you find the linearized constraints for an arbitrary triangulation. That is how they look like, and then you can also prove that they are abelian. Also, they involve quite complicated functions. so I will basically come to the summary here, more or less. So to higher order, that's the problem also, that to linearized order you have constraints. If you go to higher order, you don't get constraints, but then it's difficult to solve these basically pseudo-constraints. And this would allow only for discrete time evolution. So you have to do these step moves. Alternatively, you could try to implement Pachner moves. And the nice thing is that the quantization of these quantum moves would directly lead to a spin-form picture. Because you evolve your space-time by Pachner moves, so you would add basically things. You would get an amplitude for your entire triangulation. Okay. So you can do that and then hope that in the quantization you and fine-graining in the quantization, you might regain the symmetries, or you try to compute the perfect action. But this immediately, I will expect, gives you basically completely different phase space because you have a very non-local constraints and a larger phase space, I expect. Okay. So, again, I had this yesterday, so I will skip that. So to summarize, discrete actions generally break diffeomorphism symmetries, and we have many examples where this happens, so we can study this phenomenon in many examples. This basically can study whether we can regain the symmetries by coarse graining or by renormalization. Our canonical framework exactly mimics the covariant symmetries, so you have either constraints or pseudo-constraints. In this sense, you solve the problem of having a first class algebra if you have a perfect action. And also, if you have a first class algebra, you could basically generate a perfect action. Okay, I try to explain that this perturbative expansion is subtle, and I wouldn't know how to calculate the path integral with it, perturbatively at least. And the prospect is to try to understand the triangulation independence or dependence of these actions and then investigate the non-locality properties of improved actions to develop this lattice deformation algebra as a condition on trying to get basically better actions at some point to improve the quantum action or to basically by looking at renormalization and spin forms. And in the canonical quantization, actually, my aim is more to make these constraints in the quantum case geometrically understandable and at some point improve these constraints. Okay, in general, I think we have to explore the general mechanism and conditions for regaining gauge symmetries, because what people do at the moment is to take a discretization to compute some stuff from it, to find that the symmetries are broken, and to define that as a fundamental effect. And but it depends on your discretization, whether you have these diffeomorphism breaking effects or Lorentz breaking effects or not. Okay, thank you.
Who has a question? Okay, so I just wanted to say, do you really need to reintegrate symmetries? I mean, couldn't...
Yeah, if you don't at least in the continuum symmetry, the continuum limit, the abolition begins with freedom.
Do you?
You have abolition begins
with freedom. But do you really? Because yeah. I mean, these are, they are strongly coupled.
No, then regaining would mean that they decouple.
Yeah.
Which would mean that they turn into gatings.
Mean that?
Decoupling, complete decoupling would mean that they turn into gauge modes.
Yeah, at low energies, but really, yeah. So but at high energies, you might, they may not be an exact gauge symmetry.
Hmm?
So, I mean, if, say, space is really discrete
mm-hmm.
and on microscopic levels,
mm-hmm.
then the gauge symmetries are generally approximate at low,
yeah,
low energies.
Yeah.
So I wonder that, I mean, how important is it to regain gauge symmetries?
Yeah, I'm agnostic about whatever you would want to do, whether you define this action, which is not diffeomorphism in Meyer, as a fundamental action or not.
Mm-hmm.
But then in a case, there are many choices you can do, of
mm-hmm.
course.
Yeah.
And you can call them, each of them, fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you have to ensure that you regain these symmetries in the infrared. And there's not much literature. There's a bit of literature, but it doesn't concern, I mean, there's actually Nielsen looked at that, but it concerns compact gauge groups, and his explicitly it might not work for higher gauge groups, and the idea is to hope that these are basically very short correlation lengths and decoupled, as you say. So the question whether the symmetry emerges is an interesting question. But you will find this automatically if you try to do randomization. I mean, it's just if you try to do randomization, you basically try to find more or less the infrared physics. And in this way, this Wilsonian way. So I don't know. I mean, if two probabilities say it's basically they are, I mean, many people say it's a continuum theory.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to derive discreteness, then I think you should require that you have a first class constraint algebra. If it's continuum theory, but I mean, you might not, I don't really understand the statement, so.
Let me try to see if I can make a statement that you agree with. Because to me, what's striking is. Look, what group quantum gravity accomplished and didn't accomplish, let me see if I can state it and if you agree. At the level of spatial diffeomorphisms, the loop quantization, there's a quantization through the connection variables and finding the spin network basis, accomplished finding a Hilbert space of states which is exactly spatially diffeomorphism, right? That is exactly... that there is a constraint, the constraint algebra is first class of spatial diffeomorphism, and it was solved, and the Hilbert space is defined in closed form, the inner product is known, and so forth. Then people went ahead and said, okay, that's beautiful, you can code the Hamiltonian constraint in some regularization that, can you get the whole theory? And some stuff was done, but not convincingly, that is. I'm stating my sense, but I want to see if you agree that the Hamiltonian constraint that we found we could work with had an abelian algebra. One could define it quantum mechanically, but it seems to be physically not correct. That is not to give general relativity, not to give a theory with propagating gravitons and so forth. So we've solved part of the problem, and we've left with the problem of defining the dynamics. And then everything that follows with spin-flow models or different approaches, the master constraint program is an attempt to grapple with that. Now, it seems to me that what you're doing is extremely interesting, but it gives up that bit that was found that is possible to deal with the spatial diffeomorphisms consistently. And it seems to me the question on the table is, do you have to give that up to go ahead with the dynamics?
Okay, so there are two things. I try to define a 3D where we have at least a closed full constraint algebra for Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint. It's consistent, and I try to find a closed diffeomorphism algebra in a full discretization.
In Reggie calculus and 3D.
In Reggie calculus and 3D.
And you succeeded in that case?
I did not succeed in this case.
Well, I thought that's what it meant to get the to having found a fixed point.
No, this is this 3D full stuff. That was a completely different other project. So.
Okay.
So an answer to your question, I did not succeed to extract for discrete surface for discretization. I did not succeed in extracting the spatial diffeomorphism subalgebra. And
okay.
I think if you would try to define it, you have to get very non-linear.
Yeah.
So all
you could draw a conclusion.
This notion of loop congruity, of course, does first this other way of going first, taking first the general transformation, taking the constraints, and then defining what the thing is. And if I take a triangulation and try to make a very small time steps, but keep the discretization scale in space direction constant, so I make.
Mm-hmm.
And then, we did this computation numerically, then you calculate 3D, you calculate that, and you calculate the Hessians of your action. Then you find it funny that one of the, I think, the Hamiltonian eigenvalue, the eigenvalue which corresponds to the time deparametrization thing, goes down, and it's at zero, then it goes again. So it's really if you squash, and there's some general consideration, if you go to these squash surfaces, you do not regain diffeomorphism symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So if you try to have this continuous time in discrete space, it's difficult. So indeed, if I try to make it look at the geometric interpretation of my hypersurface deformation algebra, which is very nice. I would have difficulties in making sense all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. And the other thing is, of course, it's a perfect action. I wouldn't give up. But I don't know whether it is possible to have this perfect action for me. For the perfect action, you could get the constraints, but of course, so far I expect that to be very non-local and not different phase space. So I don't know. In 3D, nobody has managed to do that. To take this picture of having spatial diffeomorphism states and to oppose constraints, the Hamiltonian constraints. And to get symmetric quantum
machine.
Nobody has
done it. Yeah, no. I'm well aware of the issues,
yeah.
But the question to me remains, does that mean we should back up and go back to triangulations and a situation where we start with breaking the diffeomorphisms and try, you're exploring the different ways to get them back, and you're doing what has to be done if you step back to that starting point.
Uh-huh.
And you're doing it very honestly, and it's hard work, but it is giving up something. Now, the question is whether the thing that was found, which is that you could treat the spatial diffeomorphisms and solve them quantum mechanically exactly,
whether that really leads to a dead end and we have to back off of that, or whether there's a way to go forward from there. And I agree, I'm very well aware of the difficulties going forward from there. But it looks difficult to back off and lose diffeomorphisms and try to get back.
I'm not sure whether it's really solved in the sense that it really kills some degrees of freedom. But I might be wrong, I just don't understand.
But the degrees of freedom are expressed in such a different language than the linearized theory.
Yeah.
That it's difficult. It's difficult to say, which is another.
Thomas, if he does this masterclass thing and puts it on a graph, then he says we have to include the diffeomorphism constraints too. I don't, to kill the physical degrees of freedom. I don't really quite understand it, or yes, it's different versions, I see, at the moment I'm trying, you are right, that I'm trying to understand it in a full discretization because I'm confused by this thing that people say I'm in a continuum theory, half the time, and the other half the time they are in discretization. So.
Some of us are always in the continuum theory. Anyway, sorry.
I have a question. Does what Roberto said make me think about it actually? So your procedure then consists in doing the following. You have a fine discretization, you solve for the intermediate degrees of freedom, the classical equation of motion, you substitute, you get something which depends on your epsilon parameter of the fine discretization, which you send to zero. And then you get the action which you call the fixed point action. Can this procedure miss? Like any theory I take a rough discretization, I take a fine discretization of epsilon, I solve for the intermediate guys, substitute them, send epsilon to zero. Well, either I get infinity if I'm really in a bad theory, but more often than not, I will get some limit when epsilon will descend to zero.
So kind of, for this 3D, this cosmological constant, you have some conditions that...
Not necessarily cosmological constant, I think of 5-4 theory, I think of any kind of field theory.
Yeah.
I can do this procedure and I can build this action.
Yeah.
More generically, I will get some final answer, which will be the limit when I send this epsilon to zero of this action. But then I have an issue with calling it a fixed point, because generically quantum field theories don't have fixed points, like they are rather exceptional. So they are obtained in a bit of a different way. Why do you call this a fixed point of renormalization? It's not quite a renormalization transformation, and it's something which is totally generic, whereas fixed points are.
It's a moment I'm classical. I'm really classical. I take the definer to the continuum.
Okay, so you take the continuum limit, but then you don't call that a
fixed point. If I take the definite from the continuum, then this will be a fixed point action in the sense that if I do the this definite again, it won't change the action.
Yeah, but my
and
problem
then,
is that this
and
is
then
it's
called a fixed point action by the guys in the QCD.
Okay, but this
so
doesn't.
It's an action actually corresponding to trajectory.
But for any theory, basically for any almost any theory, you will be able to derive this continuum limit, which you would call a fixed point action. For any reasonable quantum field theory, you do this thing, discretize, send the discretization to zero, you'll find some equivalent of this fixed point action. So this is not quite the same thing as a renormalization fixed point. Like there are theories which don't have renormalization fixed points. You know, 5-4 doesn't have it, except the Gaussian type.
I mean, this of course assumes that there is a fixed point somewhere. I mean, what we do, again, it's classical, so, I assume that for
you're taking issue with the language, isn't it?
I'm not
going to be a conformally invariant theory, for example.
For instance, I'm not convinced that that object there, that theory you find, it's a fixed point in the sense of renormalization.
I wouldn't have already clarified yesterday, and he emphasized the difference between the trajectory that goes into the fixed point.
No, but for me, the problem is that if I take 5-4...
And there's a perfect action guys in QCD, I mean, they apply to QCD. So it's a language which applies to QCD, where for asymptotic safety, where this fixed point exists.
Yeah, but I can also...
And then they call it a fixed point action, I mean, it's a renormalization trajectory.
But I think it's fair to say, and maybe it would be helpful if you underlined it, when you were talking about refinement and coarse-grained energy calculus, you were
doing something at a classical level, which is analogous to renormalization in that there's the same steps, but it's not renormalization.
No,
it's not a quantum theory.
I don't include any fluctuations at the moment.
Yeah, so I think if you made a big sign and said, now I'm doing a new thing which is called refinement or coarse graining of classical Regi calculus, and it's interesting that there's an analogous set of steps.
Yeah.
But it has nothing to do with quantization or statistical mechanics.
Yeah, it doesn't include fluctuation.
Yeah. The question is there?
If you see, the plane basically they need to do only classical Hall's equation of motion to find the perfect action. I'm not doing any quantization at the moment. And we want to do this explicitly in the quantum case, of course, at some point.
Sure.
But.
But you're saying in QCD it suffices to do this. That's what they could. They would have got the same result if they did included the fluctuations.
Yes.
Yeah, but that theory is asymptotically free. So not only that we have a fixed point, but it's actually Gaussian.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a fixed point, which is not Gaussian, or if you don't have a fixed point.
If you do for the normalization of the Gaussian theory, you actually don't need to solve the equation of motion.
Right.
You just need to solve the second point.
If we just talk about this classical thing for a minute, wouldn't this perfect action be really hard to work with? Because it would be like a really funny. If it was really triangulation independent, it would be a really strange, like just kinematically working out what's happening would be really weird. Say you just coarse grained until you had a simple exercise of this space-time region in this lecture theory, for instance, and then you'd have to go somewhere inside the triangulation, find all the information which corresponds, if you wanted to know about all perturbations.
No, I mean, the perfect action would be very non-local object.
Yeah.
So, I guess I was hoping that there would be some, the usual edge action plus some corrections.
Oh, so to say if we were in a flat kind of space time,
so that we can
sort of say something.
Yeah, so that we could say something, when do we really, how much do we need to refine?
See it.
I mean, I don't really hope so much that we can find the perfect action at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more like finding conditions to obtain diffeomorphism invariants, because if people complain that we don't have constrained algebra.
Yeah.
Now I'm trying to tell you, getting the constrained algebra might be very difficult. This is equivalent to getting the perfect action. So we might try to explain them, but if we make sure that this and this happens, then at least in the continuum we will get that. So, I don't know. I mean, at the moment, it's just that. At the moment we ignore this, we effectively calculate with some discretization, and then that is basically the latest work of Gambini and Poli. They do a discretization, they do lots of stuff, and they find an operator which they call the master constraint operator. Then they look for even some family of solutions. They look for a solution by not really trying to solve it, but by taking some family of gate functions and trying to minimize the parameters, trying to find the parameters so that we get a minimal error. And of course, they don't find zero. They would have been surprised. But then, whether you call that fundamental discreteness or not is up to your taste, because it depends on your operator you put in, on many quantization abilities, and still it's an interesting exercise. But somehow the discretization scale, if it corresponds to the Planck scale, if you cannot go below Planck scale a lot with this effect, then I don't know how physically reliable it is.
Okay, so that's a conclusion.